Hello, my name is Michelle Yana Chan, the Wandering Book Collector, and this is my podcast, Conversations with Writers Exploring What's Informed Their Books and Their Lives Around Themes of Movement, Memory, Sense of Place, Borders, Identity, Belonging, and Home. I'm joined by the writer, Nastasia Martin, to discuss her book, In the Eye of the Wild. She writes of her encounter with a Kamchatka bear in the mountains of Siberia. Nastasia is an anthropologist who studies indigenous communities, animism, and the relationship between humankind and nature. Nastasia, welcome to the Wandering Book Collector.
Hi, I'm very glad to be here.
Well, I know you're in Venezuela right now, Nastasia. I couldn't be further from the setting of your book, In the Wilds of Siberia. Is part of the appeal of being an anthropologist the movement and the travel, or is that actually an inconvenience?
Well, that's a tough question. I would say that at first, what really made me choose anthropology, and this comes from a very, very long time, was that I was wondering if in some parts of the world existed other ways of relating to what in the Western world we call nature in different ways. So this has been a very important question for me since I was probably 10 years old. And at first, I didn't know that such work existed. When I was in high school, for example, I wanted to not only study nature or animals, that I did not only want to study humans, which would have been sociology, but I wanted to do something in between. And in this time, people in my high school told me that this job just doesn't exist. So I first studied sociology, and it's after 4 or 5 years when I encountered the work of Philippe Descola, who's a great, great anthropologist and who started the discipline that's called anthropology of nature, that I found out that I was not so crazy, and that this actually could be a job and a destiny.
Well, for listeners of the podcast, Nastasia, who haven't read your book yet, can you give them in your words a sense of what you wanted to explore or achieve by writing the book?
Well, this is a tough question also, because I think, first of all, I didn't want to achieve anything. I wanted to get this story out of me, of myself, because what I really wanted to do was to write an anthropology book about those people I was living and working with in Kamchatka, who are called the Even people. And so I wanted to write about them and not about me. But in the course of this investigation, this encounter with the bear happened, and it absolutely blurred my writing. I was not able to write anymore, because it was in some way bugging me all the time. This event that was well too big to be in this research book, but at the same time I couldn't do as if it hadn't happened. So, well, my first intention was to get this story out of me in order to be able to write this other book of research, but so that it wouldn't bug me in the process of writing. But when I started writing it, I actually realized that it was going way further than that. Because, of course, the idea was not to tell the encounter of an anthropologist and a bear, because it's a good story, but it had to had to make sense in a way. So I understood while I was writing that actually it bared meaning also from for anthropology. Because, you know, even if we say, as I was saying, oh, we have to, you know, we have to create this opening and this crack within oneself so that otherness can come in, nobody is really allowed in the academy to talk about this when we come back. You know, you have to do as if, oh yeah, it happened, but nobody talks about the condition of production of a research. This is kind of a taboo, right? Because this would be autofiction. So that's not research. So that's not academy. So you don't talk about it. But in this case, it was going a step further, because it was like, well, okay, these people tell me that other animals have souls and that you can dream with these other animals. And actually that's exactly what happened to me while I was researching on them or on their way of relating to the word, and I ended up embodying this. So this was like kind of a, well, while I was writing, I realized I was writing a manifesto of on another way of making thinking anthropology, which would be way more embodied, which would be more truthful, because it wouldn't forget the conditions of production of a research, basically. And that brought me a lot of problems at the beginning, because, well, as I was saying, you're not supposed to talk about these things, because it doesn't sound scientific enough. Which to me is a mistake to think about it like this, because well, what it shows is that those ways of relating to the world are not just cultures, you know, cultures that are thinking over on an homogeneous transcendental nature. This means that they're actually other words that exist all together. Then you could ask me, but why did I publish it in the original publisher in France is a literature publisher and not an anthropology one. Well, there's many reasons for that. One is that I wanted this story to be able to be shared with more people than just the academy. Because it was readable, because I was using literacy tools. And second, because, yeah, of course, I wanted to protect myself in a way from people in my own field who could have said, oh, I had gone out of the road. That's why I decided to not publish in an anthropology edition.
You know, given what you've just said, Nastasia, is the traditional field of anthropology just not elastic enough? And then are you trying yourself to make this sector of academia more expansive to take into account of alternative worldviews, as well as to have different layers of narrative, not just the kind of science, data-driven, more dry academic way that we've always kind of looked at that field, but also to encompass and embrace something more emotive?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. This is also one of my great motivation of that I want to keep writing with literature, because also it's way closer to the way people, indigenous people indeed, do tell stories. Because that's what people do, right? They tell stories. They tell stories, and those stories are not linear. This is the work of the researcher who comes back to his country, his office, and starts putting linearity in the story so that it will be, you know, understandable. But the reality of how they tell those stories, well, at least the people with who I worked, Guqin, the event people, they're always circular. They don't necessarily go somewhere, you know, in the way we go somewhere with a specific timeline when we talk about an event, for example. They go in circles and they go like with the mythical times very far back, and sometimes they talk about right now. So in order to have somebody feel what it means to be told this story, you have to write in another form. And literature is, to me, the closest form that can bring you there. So it becomes a tool. And it's not only a tool to, oh, feel things, because yes, this is important, if text is able to resonate, just like when, for example, Daria in Kamchatka will tell a prayer to the river. Well, she says the river listens, but why does it doesn't listen like we human listen, but it resonates for her. So I believe that a literature text can do the same, produce resonances on the people who read it. So yes, this is super important. And the second thing is that in regard of what we were talking about with the academy, to me, literature used for this purpose of thinking differently becomes a very political tool in a way. Because it's not just here to produce the effect of emotion. It's here to make you feel and think differently about the word, because you're closer to another structure, another method of thinking. And this method I didn't learn in Western books. The method, for example, with which is written in the Eye of the Wild is very animistic. It's the kind of way they tell their own stories, you know, mixing mythical time, dreams, and the actual incarnated real, if there can be such word, moment of their everyday life. So that's why I used this structure, but it was drawn from the way they actually think and talk.
I mean, it does make kind of our way of thinking and telling, and when I say I mean kind of the Western optics on experiences, it does make it feel incredibly limiting. And the Evan people who you talk about of the Kamchatka region say that you've become Miedka, a half human, half bear, and you know, and then the Western ideology of the bear as a wild animal representing strength and courage, and maybe your role in that, in the kind of the Western tone, would be as one of sacrifice, and your Evan friends also interpret your survival as a gift, as a gift from the bear to you. Yet are both of those interpretations, are they both, well, either useful or imperfect?
Yeah, I don't think useful or imperfect are the words I would use. What I Yeah, what I came across is just as you said, the bear, this encounter with the bear in the world I lived in France was, yeah, either a heroic act or a sacrificial act. And it couldn't be something else than that. A young woman who encounters the wild beast, you know. And obviously, with my anthropological background and what I had experienced with all those dreams and everything that happened before the encounter, this was absolutely invalid. But at the same time, I won't say that. I have nothing to do with sacrifice, because that would be. I mean, that would be absolutely false. Of course, I bear a collective story. I carry it with me that has to do with sacrifice, because I come from this culture. And obviously, there is, something to be said for that, because or else I wouldn't be an anthropologist. You know, I wouldn't put myself in this situation. And I did put myself in this situation. So I can't say that it's absolutely, you know, a nonsense, because that wouldn't be entirely true. But at the same time, when my Evan friend started to tell me about how the bear word had, you know, had showed gratitude by letting me leave, basically, and not killing me, and that they had done that because themselves, this family with who I lived, had been good with them. Like they, you know, they had the right kind of relation, the right kind of offerings, the right kind of prayers. So thanks to that, the bears had decided to let me leave. I was like, well, I'm sorry, but this also feels a little, you know, it bears meaning too, but it's a little on the side of. It's incomplete, or it's not enough, because there was more than that. But you know, the thing is, and this is very, very, very strange, but somebody in France in a conference asked me the same kind of question, and when I answered, well, this is the Evan way of thinking about this, to me was a bit incomplete. The person did not understand, because there is also this fascination for traditional indigenous knowledge that basically goes by they know the truth, you know, they know the truth, like we don't and they do. And to me, that's not, because I experienced that, I would have been one of those people who would have more looked towards the indigenous side, you know, how can they think better than us? How can they save us? You know, basically, this is a question I have all the time. What can we learn from them? But having lived this myself, and I mean, I nearly died. So, well, I think I earned a right of saying how I feel about this. This is where I get my entre guillemets my powers back, or as a researcher, you know, like this idea of there is more to it, and so the way, the kind of the walk through this, the, all these meanings, is what brings it meaning. But none of those particular ways of looking at this mystery resolves it. So basically, the book reflects my own journey, trying to bring meanings to what happened, and in the end, there is no one meaning, but this this walk, this journey around it. I don't know if I'm being clear, but it's very circular. This journey is very, it's like you have the mystery in the middle, and just like a hunter, you're circling it. You're circling it, and you start from far away, and little by little, you get closer and closer to the mystery that's in the center, like in a spiral way. But you never really get to the center. But that's what keeps you alive. That's what keeps you thinking. And that, to me, is a very, very important pattern. I mean, in my research and also in my own life, basically, I can say that this is exactly what kept me alive.
Nastasia, do you credit anthropology, your field of study, in some way that it helped prepare you to cope with the experience?
Yes, I mean, well, yes, and again, there is a bit more to it, but yes, absolutely. I mean, before that day, I'd been an anthropologist for 15 years. I'd been literally hunting for people who told me about animistic relationships with other animals. I've been writing about bears a bunch. I've been reading and writing about myths that implies bears and other animals, but literally it had been my life. So yes, absolutely. It's just that I would say that when I started working in Kamchatka, the difference with my field work in Alaska, everything became more real, not real in the sense of, oh, there's more indigenous people there and they're less destroyed and killed than on the American side. Real because I started experiencing it myself, basically just like an initiation of some sort, without ritual, because the shaman had been killed in the 60s in Kamchatka, so there was no shaman to teach me those ways, but there were people who still related to their dreams in a very animistic way, so I was not alone in this process, but I wasn't accompanied by a mentor or somebody that would give me all the clues. I had to walk that path on my own. But again, I mean, which is, this is also a story you find in many, many animistic collectives in the Great North, in the Amazonia, of, when it's time of initiation, there's usually a moment where you have to walk your path alone. And you will be left in the forest for how many days, how many moons, in order to become somebody else. And in this sense, the experience I had is very similar to this very, very old pattern of ritual and initiation.
I guess by living through this metamorphosis, has it also changed your lens going forward in your research, in your academic research, I'd say?
Yes. Yes, it has. Well, it changed. That's also a tough question. At the same time, I would say it did change everything because I wasn't the same person. And yes, I mean, the Evan, they did there's something to be said about this Mietka thing, you know, half-half. But that's something that has been following me since, I mean, since Alaska. The Gwich'in, my Gwich'in friends used to call me a Na'in, which means, well, kind of a woodsman or woodswoman, because I had those weird habits of climbing trees and walk alone in the forest and, you know, all these things. And so, yeah, I was not considered as totally human, although I shared this status with other Gwich'in people, which was great, because that's the thing, when you're marginal, you always have to remember that you're not alone in this position of being in between worlds. I think there's more and more people who dwell in between worlds nowadays. And so, yeah, the same for Mietka, being half and half. Yes, I mean, of course, something changed tremendously in me. I mean, physically, emotionally, spiritually, everything shifted. But I would say, too, it's very paradoxical, but it's how I feel. At the same time, nothing changed. Like, I stayed very much a very passionate anthropologist, looking forward to learn and learn more about people's ways of relating to the world, and looking forward to new projects and interesting things, and how can we go deeper in sharing this and that, and so in this sense, I stayed my, you know, my own, very motivated, young person, just like I was when I was super young, like a child, basically.
As well as the Evan people of the Kamchatka Peninsula, you've also studied the Gwich'in of Alaska. And I wanted to ask you if there was anything that you might share, something you've come across in your research that you feel could arm us, perhaps, for the world we find ourselves in now, a world where we've lost so much in the relationship between humankind and nature. And it's quite a cheap question, because I kind of want to ask you for a how-to hit list. But are there takeaways, kind of simple takeaways that we would all benefit from?
Yeah, well, that's always that question of the takeaway. it's what we want, right? because we're in a very deep, crazy crisis, all of us. So of course we would like to have ready to think recipes, you know, which would be able to save us, but yeah, I mean, I'm sorry to say that they're none. But this bridges to the former question about this in betweenness, you know, this of living on margins. I think, as I was saying, there are more and more people living on those margins, you know, of different worlds, whether that be different human worlds, whether that be different human and non-human worlds, but living at this border, which is not very quite, which could seem quite indefinite, you know, this place of hybridation. And we live in a world which is going towards hybridation more and more. So those people, you know, this place of, how to say, oneness meets with an otherness, and this hybrid comes to life. This place has been thought a lot. You know, it's like something that's present in the mythology, like it's at the basis of what the world is, you know, of how speciation happens. So I think that in this time of crisis, of where we you know, where we sometimes feel like we've never been in this place where all the boundaries between us and the outside world are dissolving, where, oh, we don't know anymore if the species we recognize, like this or that species, are those species because they're hybridating. And this, you know, all these boundaries between us and the outside world are blurring. Well, this is also a beginning. I mean, and in the myth of those people I've lived with, the mythical time are exactly this. It's this moment where a discussion has to happen between all the different parties at play who are about to create a world, in order to rethink what are going to be our boundaries of our oneselves in order to live this incarnated life. So it's a time of origin. And I think, I mean, to me, I mean, looking at this mythology and looking at the times we are living now, it's like it's kind of like the ultra modernity we are in is also can be seen as this moment of, you know, going back to this time of we have to recreate a dialogue between all those different beings in order to create an earth that's going to be livable for everybody. And that's the discussion the mythical beings were having and have been having for thousands of years. So those tools, yes, they exist, you know. Those are the kind of tools I'm trying to share. And they're not that hard to come across. And those tools, of course, that's what indigenous people have. They have it very clear. So yes, I think we should start to listen to what they're telling us again, and not in an extractivist way, because that's to me very, very important, because, you know, with your question always comes the problem of extractivism. You know, we're very good at this, like we extract. I mean, we extract whatever resource we need in the ground or in soil, but we also extract meaning, cultural meaning. So I think we have to find a way to dialogue and listen to one another without extracting, and that's. That's quite hard for us, but I think it's doable. It's manageable.
Oh, that is a very good point. Well made. I do feel like I'm just trying to harvest in my question, and I would take that to heart. I will pay attention to that going forward. Do you think, Nastasia, in your writing, that you may stick to memoir, this kind of memoir nonfiction, very literary, but also semi-academic genre that you'll pursue time to time?
Yes, well, in fact, I just published a third book, which is the book I wanted to write before I started writing In the Eye of the Wild, you know, when I was trying to write about the Dievan people, but that I couldn't because I was being blurred by this encounter. Just like the encounter with the bear changed my life in many ways, writing this book actually changed, well, not changed, but pushed even further the way, you know, I wanted to write. I dropped my fear of, you know, putting literature hybridating literature with more academical conceptual writing. And I was like, hey, maybe it's okay to write in both ways in one book. And this could be part of the dialogue that we need to have between different ways of structuring practice and thoughts. So in my last book, there are parts that are very conceptual and historical, which are, I mean, written, well, you could say that it's academical writing, although I hope it's readable. And there are parts that are very, what we call in French, récit, that are stories. Well, basically, I tell stories. And I tell stories with this literacy tool that is, again, you know, who following the stories people tell me there, or more than the stories, I mean, more than what is in the story, the structure of the story. Like I was saying in the beginning, you know, more in like spiral circle. And so I think, I mean, I wasn't sure. It was an experiment. I really didn't know if it was going to work or not, basically. But I thought this experiment was needed because, you know, it's either you write a story and then you're outside of the academic field, so your words don't hold scientific value, or it's either you write in academic or conceptual way and then you have value, but nobody reads you. I mean, nobody outside of the academy. So I was like, this is one of the problem also, you know, those different ways of writing have to communicate. And what happens if we actually create a dialogue between these different ways of writing inside the book, which also, and so there's different layers that this could be read, but it's also a dialogue between, let's say, the Western linear way of thinking, which will be the more conceptual writing, with the indigenous one, which will be more like storytelling. And so using literature for on one side and more conceptual academical writing on the other. I don't know. I mean, again, it's for the readers to say if it works, if it doesn't work. But I like this experiment and I think I'm gonna keep doing it. I mean, it's gonna change, obviously, because one book cannot be identical to the second. But yeah, thinking to me is very important to think about the method, you know, the methodology one has in a book. And this writing can be viewed as methodology. And one thing I would like to add with this is that why is writing, you know, in thinking about the structure of writing is very important to me, like, you know, the kind of words you put in the word. Again, this is linked to what people told me in Kamchatka, which is every word you put in the word is performative, saying it produces an effect, it has meaning for other beings than yourself, which in the case of the event people, for example, among many others, those beings can be indeed other than humans. So this idea that the words are performative, you know, so that means that you have to think really hard before you say something, because you might be heard. This is what event people say. Shh, like, don't say anything too loud, because they might hear you and they might respond, because there's only the possibility of, always there is the possibility of response, the response of the animals, but also the response of the response of the tender, for example, or of the water. So basically when you talk, it tends towards prayer, you know, it's almost like a prayer, because you put a certain kind of energy, because you know you can be heard. A lot of indigenous thinkers do say, and it's absolutely understandable that they say that we by writing we lost this power of of producing meaning for the world, you know, outside of humans, and that writing cuts this possibility, because we're not addressing the world, we are addressing ourselves, basically. So that writing will always bring a distance between you and the world, which well thought words or prayer does not. Well, I do not agree with this. I think that, and literature can help us with that, I think that we can view a text in a way like a prayer, you know, to think that this particular words will produce an effect on the people who receive it, your reader, you know, which is why I always bear in mind my reader when I write, because my words are destined to him. So I aim, and of course I aim a transformation, an inner transformation in my reader. So in a way it's a very animistic way to think about writing, but I think it holds some meaning. And think about also, you know, when you read the silence you're in, like some sort of, you know, it's concentration, but it's also, I mean, it's very powerful to receive the word of somebody within this inner silence that requires reading.
Just to return, Nastasia, to your description of your third book, is that, what's the name of that, and has it been translated into English yet?
It's being translated by Sophie Lewis too, the same person who translated On the Eye of the Wild, In the Eye of the Wild, and it's being translated this year. She's actually translating it right now. So and I don't know how it will be called in English yet, but in French it's called À l'Est des Rêves, which basically means to the east of dreams. To the east of dream in my head is when you wake up from your dream, you come back to incarnation in the morning, and it's what do you do with what happened in this moment of encounter, which can be the dream, if I mean not in the modern sense, but in a more animistic sense, you know, this moment where actually your soul can get out of your body and encounter other beings, which are not necessarily human, but because you're not with your body, you don't need your own language to interact. So basically encounter can happen in this place, and then when you come back in the morning, let's say, you wake up with things that are not yours. And that's also, you know, that's also a metaphor for a lot of things, actually, but for anthropology, for instance. So that's why I called this book To the East of Dreams, because what do you do with all this when you come back in the morning and you have to go about in the world with all that? What do you do with what has been put in you? What path do you take?
Finally, Nastasia, my last question for you is one I ask most of the writers who come on The Wandering Book Collector, about where you think of or where you call home.
I call home, is that a real question or a metaphorical question?
Well, it's probably however you want to take it, but love two answers if you have two answers.
I'm just asking this because one day a psychoanalyst or two psychoanalysts were assisting of one of my conference, and when I got out, they came talk to me, and they asked me this question: where do you live? But with a very mysterious look in their face, like they were trying to analyze me, right? Where do you live? And so Obviously, I didn't want it to be analyzed at this time, so I responded, "Well, it depends," but I was joking, and they took it very seriously. Yeah, so usually that's what I respond to this. It depends, so that I don't get in trouble.
Obviously, I'm not analyzing you. I promise you, I'm not analyzing you, Nastasia. It's quite as simple. But yes, it's complicated, but it's certainly not to kind of then make a judgment on your on what you.
No. I call home a very small village in the French Alps, which is called Villard d'Arène. It's in the High Alps. It's a 1,800 meters high. It's very mineral, actually. There's not a lot of forest. There's not a lot of predators apart from wolves now that are coming back. But yeah, it's a place where I feel like I can rest and not dream too much, which is not the case when I'm in the forest, for instance. So yeah, this mountain place with the glacier just above and the rocks all around, this is where I go home.
If I'm allowed one more, then do you think you will always be itinerant, in part because of the nature of your job?
Well, again, that's not for me to say. I mean, who knows? I mean, we've all seen that with the COVID and what happened. I mean, is this kind of job? I mean, even if I love working with Indigenous people very far away, and I have traveled to find the kind of knowledge and relation to the world that they have here, well, here in France. Because maybe it's been lost for longer. Who knows what will happen? I mean, I don't know for how long we'll be able to keep traveling like this. And again, I mean, I'm very, very well aware that it's not a very sustainable way of living either, you know, and that's a great criticism that has been made towards anthropology, and I mean, it holds a lot of sense, which is, I mean, in a way, you know, it's a prolongation of colonialism. And I mean, what is the sense of like flying over so far away to, you know, bring back knowledge? I mean, it's crazy when you think about it this way. So, but hey, you know, that's the world I was born in. That's the, and I mean, this has been my life. I think I try to, to share these stories I try to share the stories in a different way. So that it can hold meaning again, because for me that's the most important and what we lack. But I mean, if all this had to stop for some reason, I would absolutely, I mean, this would be right. So I will respond, I don't know. And I think most of us, we're all in this situation of, you know, looking towards the future with everything that's happening and thinking, I don't know, because we don't know anymore. So yeah, I think it's important to not lose time sharing these stories and bringing back heart and meaning in our lives, because I don't think we have a lot of time to reverse the craziness we're in. So yeah.
On that note, Nastasia Martin, thank you very much for joining me on The Wandering Book Collector.
Thank you, Michelle.
And to my listeners, if you like the podcast, please take a moment to rate us on the app you use to tune in. We want our guests to be read more. and heard more, and strong ratings help make that happen. Thank you. Until next time.